Hi, this is Don McLean, and you're listening to Life Minute.
He gave us one of the most iconic songs of all time.
I started singing bye-bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry.
At 78 years young, American treasure Don McLean is still giving us great music. We were so fortunate to have him back at the Life Minute Studios recently to tell us all about his latest album, American Boys. 13 tracks honoring rock and roll and those who paved its way. This is the Life Minute with Don McLean.
How have I lasted this long? That's the key now. That's the question.
Longevity.
How did I do it?
How did you do it?
Don't push yourself. Live to fight another day. Don't rush around too much. Jim Croce died rushing him around. The wonderful Ricky Nelson, beautiful Ricky Nelson, died rushing him around all over the place. All these artists died rushing around Patsy Cline. Rush, 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 rush. It never gets through their head. I know so many stories about this. One day I said, don't push me. I'll go when I'm ready. We'll do it the way I want to do it. Biggest, best decision I ever made, because I ran and ran until 1974, and I had a nervous breakdown. Couldn't leave the house, crying all the time. No one, I mean, I was a mess. I don't go to doctors. Let's work my way out of it, you know. But I know what it was. Combination of emotional and physical exhaustion.
How old were you when that happened?
I don't know, 1975, I was about 29. But I figured it out. This is what kills people. You know, I wasn't equipped for this. You know, you don't grow up being equipped for fame and stardom and everything, and money. So I used to deliver the Standard Star in New Rochelle. That's in the song, you know, every paper I delivered. I was only a paper boy. That's the only job I ever had. I learned how to make a living with a guitar after that. But this lady came to interview me after I had become very famous, and she wrote this article. I said, Don McLean is a millionaire, right? And I thought about all those girls whose parents didn't want me to take their daughter out, you know.
Retribution.
They now changed their whole tune, you know. I told her not to do that, but she went and did it anyway.
I know you were so young when you started. Did you always know you wanted to be a musician?
That's the only thing I was any good at. The only thing that got any reaction that made me think that I was different than other kids was when I sang. When I would sing, the mothers would call my mother, mostly Jewish mothers. I had all Jewish friends in school. The connection with me and Israel and all that goes a long way back, because they were the most interesting kids, you know, they were fun and crazy. They would call my mother and say, oh, everybody loved Donnie singing. You have to do something with that. And my mother, I never met Mrs. Kassen before, you know, she called me. I loved to do it. And then Elvis Presley and the Kingston Trio happened almost at the same time. You guys, everybody was playing guitars and banjos, and Elvis was playing guitar. And I think, boy, you know, if I could just play one of those things, I could, you know, be a contained person. Just fell right in my lap. I mean, the folk thing, all of a sudden there were little records where you could learn how to play some guitar. You know, a guy named Jerry Silverman, how to play the folk guitar. You know, he learned to play a few licks and do this and that. It just was magic. You know, everything fell right in my lap. It was amazing. I mean, because prior to that, if you wanted to be a singer, you'd have to read music and sing with an orchestra. And I didn't want to do that. I can't read music, and I didn't want to sing with an orchestra. But this was perfect, and I loved it so much. And banjo, too, five-string banjo. I became a really good folk banjo player, and I used to be on a lot of records. So I would augment my living. People would call me in to play because I was good at it. I learned from Pete Seeger and Eric Darling and the best. Whoever knew how to do this taught me everything they know how to do, and I know how to do it all.
When did you get your first guitar?
Well, I think about 12. Somebody taught me a couple of chords on the guitar. If you teach a kid E, A, B, 7, three chords, you can play almost anything. In fact, my son loved Meatloaf, you know, and he got a songbook and everything. And I said, Wyatt, these are simple songs. So let me show you these three chords. In a month, he was playing every Meatloaf song on his guitar. And he became an A student. Going from sports to music turned him from being a B student to an A student. Why, I don't know. But it was the best move I could have made with him.
Did your parents do that for you? Were they supportive for your music career?
No. My father was anti-music, anti-show business, anti-all that stuff. I think in his heart, he thought everybody in show business was some kind of a pervert. But my mother was Italian, and she liked my singing. And so she would always encourage me to sing. And she would get the vapors, you know, she would be so happy with the songs. And my Italian cousins would always be in the car and say, Donnie, sing us a song, you know. So there was a little bit of ambivalence there. But anyway, my father passed away when I was 15. Then I was in charge of my whole life. Nobody could tell me anything. I remember telling my mother, I did everything for my mother. I said, don't tell me what to do anymore because I'm not going to do it. I know what I've got to do. And I took care of her, you know. And she told me, you know, I didn't raise you, you raised yourself. I fell in love with a guitar, you know, and I'm still in love with a guitar. Still in love with it. I get them, I have them fixed up. I've got, sit in a room when we see TV, there's 8 guitars there, you know, and I'm always picking them up and playing them. And I love to sing and perform because I get to play and be with the guys.
What about writing? When did you know you could write?
I don't know what happened to me. So I remember about 1964 thinking maybe I could write a song because I'd heard simple Woody Guthrie songs, you know, but they're not so simple. And they take a person who has a lot of empathy and understanding of history and of common, regular, hardworking people, which I certainly did not have. But I thought I could write a simple song with a chorus, you know, which is really what American Pie is. It's a complicated song with a chorus, but it's still a folk song in that sense. But I had no confidence in myself that way. The way I had confidence was in myself was as a singer. You know, I thought I could sing songs, I could, and I started to play the guitar, I started to get good at it. And I started to, you know, really know what I was doing, you know, in that realm. And then a few songs came, I don't know how to describe it, but it built. And then I got near Seeger in the late 60s, and a lot of songwriters were around, and I'm very competitive. I started thinking, you know, what can I do to really do something that's great, you know, and came up with this Tapestry album, which had all these songs on it, and that changed my life. The next album I did, I was world famous. You can't imagine what it's like to be world famous in a minute, and it stays that way. You go to these countries and they all want to hear these songs. They never forget you. I liken it to being like Valentino in the silent era of movies. We live in this computer age now with all of this, you know, networking, and there's a million things going on. Television is everywhere all the time. In those days, there were only 3 stations that broadcast hits in New York. When you were number one, you were played morning, noon, and night on that station to everybody, millions and millions and millions of people. It was like being a silent screen star. You know, all they would do, they would go to the movies, they would see Valentino, or they would see Douglas Fairbanks or whoever. And that was the total focus of the whole community. And that's exactly the same as what it was like to have a number one record. And I had 3 of them over a period of time, and a lot of minor records that were pretty famous off of albums. So for about 15 years, and then, but things started to morph over, you know, into the, you know, vinyl ended, and the DVD, the CD came, and you had a whole dance thing, which started to take hold in the mid-70s. And really, rap music is dance music. You know, but then you had, you know, amazing people like Prince and Michael Jackson and coming up and doing an athletic event, you know, to perform. And it was not something we were going to do. I'm standing in front of the microphone. So Garth Brooks has me come to Central Park in 1997. He's been singing my songs for all these years from the time he was not well known until he was this gigantic star. And I see this huge stage, and I told the guy, listen, you want in-ear microphones and stuff? I said, no, I just stand there. And he's running all over that stage, man. He's like a athletic event again, you know?
And it's not just him. Madonna, Drake, Tupac Shakur, Josh Groban have all done your songs multiple times.
Well, it makes me happy that people from all different areas in life are interested in my ideas that I like, because I'm an idea man. That's what these records are for. I'm not a consistent hit maker. I've had some hits.
Some. Only the most important ones of all time.
I saw Bob Dylan in 1962. Sing at a concert that Pete Seeger brought him there. It was a hootenanny at Carnegie Hall. And I saw him sing Hard Rains Are Gonna Fall. And I saw him sing some of these songs. And you can imagine how straight everybody was in 1962, right? I left that hall thinking, man, I never heard anything like that. Suddenly poetry mattered. Yeah. Words really mattered. So it wasn't just like this land is your land and this land is my land. It was something entirely different. And luckily for me, I was able to make some records and get some stuff, my best work, across to people. A miracle, really, because, you know, I was very reticent. I was not anxious to be famous as such. I didn't mind it, you know. But from the time I had started playing guitar, I had always had girls chasing me. I mean, and when I would look out there, you know, in 1971, there'd be 5,000 women with their hair parted in the middle or wearing granny glasses, you know, wanting to take me home. And it was wild, man. It really was. And it went on for years. I didn't understand that. I didn't know what I had gotten myself into.
What do you mean?
I just didn't understand it. It's unprecedented. If you grew up in my house, my father was a salesman. And my mother was a very quiet woman who wasn't a gregarious or a mingler, you know, one of those loud drinking people, you know. No. My mother was, both my parents did not want to be noticed. As a matter of fact, they had a group of friends that were, if you were too rich, you couldn't crack that group. They didn't really want people around who were too splashy, you know. They're a very classy little group they had, you know.
Did your mom see you become famous?
Oh, yes. Yeah, all the way through crying in the 80s. Yeah, she saw me, and by this time I'd been around for, like, you know, 15 years. They were in their 40s when I was born, and I had a sister who was 15 years older than me. And I had my grandmother, my father's mother, and they would all be in the house. My mother, my father, my grandmother, and my sister, they're all smoking, all giving me asthma. I was either, as a little guy, you know, I was either amusing to them or I was in the way. So there was a lot of inconsistency, you know, especially with my sister. But I would say some things, and one thing I said is, I am going to be famous, and I'm going to buy, Mom, and I'm going to buy you a mink coat. Well, gales of laughter. I mean, do you know what Donnie said? He said he's going to be famous and buy Betty a mink coat. Well, you know. I have a picture of my mother in the mink coat going to Carnegie Hall.
Oh, it's awesome. It's fantastic. Do you know now, do you believe that you're a good writer?
I don't know what I am. I just know that I've reached a lot of people and made them happy. And that's all. And they have made me happy. My audience has given me everything. They've given me everything, you know, and they've stood by me and made me into somebody well-respected and wealthy and everything else. I owe the audience everything for this, and I'm always aware of that, and I try to sing well and do the best I can every night. I hate performers that go up on stage and cry about their troubles. They don't care.
That's smart.
They have their own troubles.
Right.
They come to see you to forget their troubles. That's what you're supposed to do. I once saw Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. I never forget this. They opened to the Beach Boys, and they were on tour as the opening act of the Beach Boys, who had Help Me, Rhonda. At the time, we were as hot as Pistols. And they got on stage and, man, we don't like the food around here and the bus is really drafty. And I'm sitting in my seat, will you shut up and sing? You know, I hated it. Really annoyed me. A lot of whining in that group.
What about politics? Do people expect you to talk about politics?
Politics? I don't think we've ever seen anything like what we're seeing now because people are so afraid to express their real opinions. And there's a lot of ugliness out there. I mean, to complain that Jerry Seinfeld was Jewish and speaking at Duke University where he has two kids, I never thought I'd live to see anything like that. You know, where you complain about the background of an individual rather than whether or not he was. I mean, we had it on my college at Iona. We had H. Rapp Brown. We had Muhammad Ali when he was banned from boxing. We had, I don't know, a whole lot of people who were speakers who were very radical, Black Panthers and stuff. And also all the usual ones, you know, Jacob Javits, you know, and people that were popular in New York. Governor Rockefeller. And we discussed this in, you know, in a civilized way on campus, you know, about what do these people have to say? And so you'd have an open discussion. Now minds are closed. Everything is either you believe what we believe or, you know, get out of my sight. You know, that's not college. That's fascism of some kind. I've said it in interviews today. If people are supporting Hamas and the destruction of Israel, the destruction of all the Jews of the world, they are continuing Hitler's agenda. That is what they are doing. Mm-hmm. There's no way around it. And now these people are taking up that, and that's what they should be branded as and what they're doing.
Do you think it'll turn around?
I think we're going to make it through. I think, you know, that the law will work. I wish that we would stop being so in love with billionaires and stuff. You know, who has the biggest house and the biggest, and that's very trashy. It's gauche, you know, it's not classy. I mean, how about beauty, you know, elegance, design, you know, that's intelligent, but that's what college is supposed to teach you. I mean, it all really irks me, you know, I mean, this, who has the most, who has the biggest, who has, you know, more and more and more all the time. That's something ugly about that.
So your mom taught you well. She'd be very proud. I want to talk about And I Love You So.
I wanted to try to write a song like the ones I heard when I was a little boy on the radio, the popular music of the 1940s and 50s, which we were brought up on. That was our staple, you know, White Christmas. And then Elvis came, and that was a sea change. And I had a friend whose father, he was the announcer on the Tommy Dorsey show. And that was where Elvis first made one of his early TV appearances. And one of my friends was there, and he was like 12. And he said, I thought he was a comedian. That's how funny Elvis was compared to the normal person and the normal person's movements and behavior. He was a comedian. You know, and all this stuff. And normal person sitting there, Leonard, would you please get me a cold drink? You know, here's this guy doing all this stuff. And that contrast, Elvis is in the DNA of the country now. He's built in to the whole thing. But we can't see the contrast like he could see at that moment.
How old were you when you wrote that song?
Oh, 23, 24. Yeah, I had a good run with that Tapestry album. I was very inspired. And I wanted to put so many different kinds of music because I was interested in so many different things. And that set the framework for everything that came after.
How does it come for you? The words first and then the music?
I just sing it into the tape recorder. If you see the movie, The Day the Music Died, you'll see the first part of American Pie. I had this thing brewing. I just sang the whole thing right into the tape recorder, right up through till the day the music died, the whole slow part in the beginning. And it just came out of me. It was like a genie out of a bottle. I said, what is that? I'm up there on my own. It's like, man, that's wild. What is it? You know, and I said, I knew I'd captured, finally, after 10 years, I'd captured what I wanted to say about Buddy Holly's plane crash. I did it. And now I said, well, I can't let this go. This has got to be right. You know, so I took 3 months and I thought about it, came up with this crazy chorus and then a structure for the song. And then I came up with this concept, which is that politics informs music and music informs politics. And that's very normal because the same population is producing the politicians and the musicians. So they have the same, you know, background, and but moving forward. So as we move forward through the 60s, this happens, that happens. This, the rest of the music changes. Everything gets wilder. Finally, you get to the end. Now I see some very dumb music and very dumb politicians. And I'm thinking the theory is right. I'm thinking to myself, you know, you're right. You're right. It's like all these years later, it still works.
He's another one that was rushing, right? Buddy Holly, a little bit rushing around. And
there's quite a bit of a backstory to that, because Buddy left Norman Petty, left the Crickets, left all that. And I don't know, whatever reason, he got married and he moved to New York. I think Maria Elena was from New York. But anyway, he lived in New York in an apartment. And they were having a baby. But what I have heard, certain people in charge of his money kept the money from him so that it would force him to come back in order to do what he was supposed to do. And I'm not going to mention any names. But he then had to take that disastrous tour, you know, where he had to sing every single night under these conditions in order to make the money that he needed. And there are stories of Buddy sitting at on Sundays watching the kids play guitars and banjos in Washington Square Park and being recognized. But he was figuring out something. The folk thing was huge. It's hard to really relate because it fizzled when the Beatles came along. But the Kingston Trio were an enormously popular group. And they popularized the idea of playing guitars and banjos and singing songs. And you'd be surprised at the musical instruments that came out of people's attics in those days. This is grandma's five string. This is grandpa's guitar. So I got way into that, you know, collecting instruments and learning about them. Martin guitars, Gibson guitars. It was a wonderful thing because all of us kids started making our own music. You know, and you'd run into guys from Yonkers or whatever who were great players, and you'd play with them, you know, meet them. And I had this friend named Mike Krupp. His father was very wealthy. Had a big. I love big houses. I always just like to get into rich kids' houses so I could see that. I was fascinated with architecture. That's why I have five homes. I love architecture, and I love furnishing everything and designing the rooms and fabrics and silver and art and everything, beautiful furniture. I couldn't drive. Everybody had to drive me everywhere. I just couldn't pass the test.
Oh, really?
I'd get carried away or go too fast or whatever. So he would drive me to Greenwich Village. We'd get in the car, him and maybe a couple other people. He lived in Yonkers, come and pick me up. And we go to New York, and I'd go to the Folklore Center and see the kids playing in Washington Square Park. And we formed a little folk group together in 1962 when we were teenagers. And we played a night at an Israeli coffee house. The first job I ever had on stage, you know. Then formed in my mind the idea of that I was good enough to do this. It sustained me. I don't know how it did it. I was so sure, and I loved it so much, that I was so sure I could do this. You know, I went through all the 60s. I went to college. I got out. I quit school, went back. All this stuff happened. I still never shook my belief that I was. And I got my degree, and by this time I knew Seeger. And I remember getting my degree and looking up and saying, well, Dad, I did it. And now I'm going up the river. And so I went up the river and played folk music with Pete Seeger for 7 years. Learned a lot. We were in the beginning of the environmental movement with the Hudson River Sloop. So I was around all that 50 years ago. And I heard the scientists talk about exactly what was going to happen in 50 years if we kept on. And now I'm here, it's all happening. You see the poor polar bears wandering around on the ground with the ice going away. You see everything changing. I understand why young people are so upset and frustrated. because this has all been done ahead of them. They can't do anything about it. You're not going to believe the stuff that's going to happen that's going to make you want to cry. When you see everything you can imagine wash up on these shores from an ocean that can't support life, which is heading that way. In Malibu, I don't care how rich it is, you're going to have a dead whale there and everything else stinking to high heavens. You're going to have it in Haiti where the people are poor everywhere. We're, the whole world of human beings are going to be crying over what we've done. And it's going to be really obvious and apparent. It's coming. It's coming because we're not changing anything. Plastic, nitrogen, fertilization. You take these beautiful areas, like they used to have these fields in Lexington. I drive in both sides all the way down. There'd be nothing but fields and horses, all condominiums. It's so easy to put a house there. Well, it's not easy to take all the trees out and to do what they had to do to get it to be what it was. We'll push the amount out of a third of the amount of soil with all this nitrogen, and it goes in and it kills the ocean and kills the waterways. I don't know. I mean, it's, I don't get into this too often. I don't know why. I don't know how you did this to me, but you did it.
I know. You could feel it with the weather, actually. You know, like when, I mean, well, it's May, it's freezing.
When we had the pandemic, the ozone hole closed. To me, it was a big deal because they've been saying people caused it, and there's no proof that they did, because the only time in history when no cars, no planes, no nothing were going for a year, closed right up. That's a fact.
All right, let's talk about American Boys, a tribute to your rock and roll heroes.
Yes, but it's also a chance to tell the American public that American Boys invented rock and roll. We invented rock and roll, we invented jazz, we invented the blues. We are Americans. It's very important to remember that. We have been in a very judgmental cycle where everybody's always knocking the country. And yet, by the same token, the things we should be doing, which are getting young people in physical shape with phys ed and everything else, everybody's saying, oh no, don't make fun of people who are too heavy. It's not a right thing to do. Well, I'm not making fun of them, but it's not healthy, and we're not a healthy country unless we start to get healthy and face reality. We can't justify everything all the time. We can't give everybody a trophy. Everybody is not a winner. I lost so much when I was growing up. I was always on a team that didn't win. I would strike out or I'd miss a ball somewhere. And you got killed for doing that. And you didn't do it anymore.
No, it's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. Thunderstorm Girl, is that about Paris?
Thunderstorm Girl is but the Mexicali Gal is about my girl, Paris. Thunderstorm Girl could be about her for sure. But she hasn't left me yet, though. So then,
take me through some of the songs, some more.
I like Thunderstorm Girl. It's a good record.
I like it. It's a great record. It sounds great.
I like the Marley's song, Save Yourself. I'm proud of that song. I think that, again, is a very important message for people to realize that you only have these moments. We are alive. We are, you know, we are miracles. And we have these moments to do things. You know, good things, bad things, do nothing, you know. But we have only this time to do it. It's passing quickly. And we have to do the right thing, you know. And I think that the problem is that there's all this judging going on. And there's all this extremism, which really closes the mind to other points of view. You know, I used to make fun of George Wallace and that stuff when he was. Then I started going down south and working in Tennessee and knowing more of my Christian friends down south, and I fell in love with them, you know, and I understand their point of view, and so I was able to realize that we all have something we can add, you know, to the discussion. There's nothing wrong in believing in something, whether it's your religion or your family or whatever.
Vacant Luxury. What's that about?
Vacant Luxury? That's a sleeper on the record. That's about everything. That's about all this excess that I'm talking about. You can't live but in one place at a time. You know, and you read about all these people that have 10 homes, and me, I have 5. But I have reasons why I'm not having any more. I love the idea of just the whole, what happened to people during the pandemic, running away from the cities and running to rural places, you know, that were very much not of any great interest to them, but only because they were frightened, you know. And remember all the dead people piling up in the hospitals and ventilators and all that stuff was going, was awful, you know. And how we got through that, I'll never know what we did. And nobody wants to look back on it either, but it was very real. So I like the idea of suddenly college is very meaningless in a way. It all happened during that pandemic. Kids had paid to go to school. Now they couldn't be with each other. They had to work from home. They weren't getting any proms or football games or all the stuff that goes along with it. And there was a whole big mess that happened in there. It messed everything up. And it could happen again. And we know it, because once one thing happens once, you're always waiting for the other thing to happen.
I feel like some things we didn't learn from it. Like, you know, when you go out to a restaurant, I think people should still wear a mask because you're touching my food. I don't know. I think we should have learned a little more from it.
I think we should have more germs, not less.
You do?
Yeah, I shoveled a lot of horse shit in my day, and I know. I got the vaccine because I couldn't perform overseas.
Right.
You know, I don't know what to do. I don't know any answers. Nobody does. You just got to go with your gut about certain things. But
oh, the Ballad of George Floyd.
My mother used to come to me at night, and when I was damn near dying of pneumonia, she would give me a bat to hit the floor with. Say, if you can't breathe, I'll come to you. I would be reluctant to do it because I'd have to wake her up at 2 a.m, you know, and I'd be crying and sweating and the bed would be wet and everything, you know, sweating. And she'd get alcohol on me and a cold. It was awful. She'd be crying and worrying. Oh, Donnie, what's the matter? What can I do? You know, I couldn't do anything. So she pulled me through, you know, a lot of times. I heard this guy calling for his mother, and I said, you know what, he ain't that dangerous, you know, because I know what it's like. So I just came out of me again, just wrote the song and right there, you know.
Amazing.
Told what it is, what he said. He couldn't breathe.
What's your favorite song to play live?
I like American Boys. We play it before American Pie sometimes at the end of the show. I like Thunderstorm Girl, I like the George Floyd song, I like the Marley song, I like Truth and Fame. We sometimes do a few, I knew a lot of blues guys growing up, and I was so lucky to be in Greenwich Village in the 60s when, you know, John Hurt and all those folk performers. I knew Josh White, I mean, Brownie McGee and Sonny Terry, I used to work with them. And I got to live with them, actually, in Lenox, Massachusetts. Sometimes I'd be the opening act, and they'd put us in a communal area, and they'd be playing, and I'd listen during the day and learn blues things from Brownie. So there's a lot of, I learned the blues. And Vincent really is a kind of blues, when you think about it. You know, there's I write a lot of blues songs.
How does such a young man have all of that? Like, how could you write those songs that are so poignant, that poetry, really?
I love ideas, and I've been gifted with a receptive system of some sort. I think about it as getting things on my radio, and I have these ideas, and I have these, sometimes the whole song will come to me in the morning and on my radio. And then I got to run to the tape recorder and try to sing it in there before I forget it, because it's subtle. There's subtle things that have to be right.
So you really do sing it. It's not like you write the words down. You actually sing the melody.
Yeah, I'll sing the words and the melody right into the tape recorder, and then I'll get a form going, and then I'll work back off of it and start to write words to fit the next part of the form. But the form is established with that how it always has been, both together. Because that way it flows out of you in a singing way. You know, it sings because you're singing it, you know, it works.
Starry, Starry Night. I love that one too.
That was written when I was living at a place called the Sedgwick House in Lenox, Massachusetts. I was an unknown, and I got a job singing in the school system. the high schools, the colleges, the grammar schools for a certain amount every week. And they would have pretty famous people. Yo-Yo Ma did some sort of thing with these schools, and I did this thing. And they would put you up in this house where the home, the Sedgwick house, which is where Edie Sedgwick came from, who joined the Velvet Underground. She was one of those Brahmins that went nuts, you know, they do it every now and then. Timothy Leary and stuff like that. I got to know the lady there. She was a classy lady. The house was filled with beautiful antiques. And I was sitting down reading this story about Van Gogh, book about him written by his brother. And I thought, well, it'd be a really good idea. I wrote the song. I sang it into my tape recorder. I worked on it, I think, for a day or two. And then I had a job singing it like at a high school thing at night. And I took the paper with me, and I sang it to these kids. And they weren't paying any attention to me at all. You know, they were with their dates, and they were drinking and talking. And all of a sudden, I sang Starry, Starry Night. Quiet. I thought to myself, wow, that's beautiful. That's amazing. I knew I had something. Because if you could get them to shut up and really listen, which they did, I said, there's something there. Success ruined me. You know, I never had the same concentration. I never had the same innocence. I never had the same yearning. I was successful, and I had a lot of money, and there was pressure on me to sell seats and sell records, and the whole thing became an unpleasant exercise. And I continued. I did some good work, but I never had the adoration that I had for record making and even the whole business as I did in the first, let's say, three albums I made. The Don McLean album is important. It's like a trilogy. That's my story. What happens to a lot of people who are not really performers as such, because performers are tough people. I'm a poet and more of a thinker. I go with feelings and with romance and with emotion. And it just was different, you know? So nothing lasts forever, you know?
Well, this album's really good, so all these years later.
The first three albums really are me in a nutshell.
What's something no one knows about you?
Why would I tell them? Then they'd know. I'm a Western film expert. Yeah, I know about Western films. Cowboy movies.
Is it true you have like over 30 custom-made cowboy, or 50 custom-made cowboy boots?
Oh, I have.
You probably have hundreds now.
I know about saddlery and horses and Western history and Western movies and Western movie stars. And the early ones, the great ones, Tom Mix, Buck Jones, Tim McCoy, Ken Maynard. These were very interesting breed of man. They were all a little like Evel Knievel. You know, they did their own stunts. They invented stunts that were wild on the screen. They wrote their own scripts, and they were beautiful. They were beautiful to look at. They designed their own new horses. For example, you'll see Tom Mix get in between the traces of a horse, running top speed, go down under the stagecoach, climb up the back of the stagecoach, go to the top, and then grab the reins and be in control of the coach. That is used even today in Mission Impossibles and stuff. They will, the horse transfer, you know, where you're riding against the train and they transfer off onto the train. It's called a transfer. That was pioneered by Tom Mix. They still do things like that with cars. And so a lot of the ideas that he had in these early silent movies, because they shot real guns, real bullets, and they did their own stunts and invented all this stuff.
And you have horses too, right?
I still have three.
Nice, nice. And a lot of cowboy boots. I heard you have a huge cowboy boot collection.
Oh yeah, I had a big auction. So I sold a lot of my clothes and cowboy boots, and I still have a lot, some saddlery.
What would your current self say to your younger self?
Don't get married.
Hey, Paris, so she's listening. What's your favorite comfort food?
Meatloaf. Corned beef and cabbage. Mm. I love it. I know how to make it. One of the things I've done in the last 3 years, I've become a cook. I can cook many things. You know, I couldn't cook before. now it doesn't faze me. If I ever want something, I go in the kitchen and I start making it. And it's fun, too.
Do you have any pets?
I have a dog named Custer, who's a Chihuahua. He runs the whole house. My girlfriend Paris and I, we serve Custer. Custer's the boss. He sleeps with us. He goes with us. He recently went on a trip to Key West, Florida, and came back, and he was a beautiful dog. And my girlfriend and her mother are going to go to Italy for 5 or 6 days, and I'm going to be with Custer all by myself.
What's something you always bring with you when you travel?
My belt buckle. This is
the belt buckle.
My buckle. And I want you to see it.
I love it. Oh, wow. That's beautiful.
And I want you to see what it says inside.
Wow. Don McLean, King of the Trail.
And this is something I designed with a great designer named Amat Khan. I have a favorite photograph, and I had him, a modeler, extract that.
Wow.
And put it, and we created this.
That's beautiful.
The rider riding at, right at you off the buckle.
Oh, wow. Is that the one you always take with you?
Yeah, I have several, but I take this one.
Special.
And good luck. It always keeps me grounded, I guess.
So great. Such an honor to have you here again with us. To see more of this interview, visit our website, lifeminute.tv. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast, Life Minute TV.